Well, all right, then. Here we go. Welcome, Dr. Charles Till.
Well, thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Dr. Till, where are you?
I'm in Idaho Falls on a very pleasant night, at midnight here in Idaho, I would say.
Okay, excellent. So a little bit then about yourself. How does one, particularly early on like that, get into the nuclear power field?
Well, you must remember the time, a long time ago, the 1950s. Nuclear energy was the way of the future. It was accepted by pretty much everyone, the professionals, scientists, public. In fact, I think too much was expected of it, if anything. Nuclear power was supposed to...
Save us.
Save us, yeah. It'd be an endless source of electricity. Famously, electricity too cheap to meter. The public was very supportive. You know, heaven knows the introduction of nuclear couldn't have been more dramatic in the form of the bomb, but it was, you know, it's rather like introducing fire through TNT.
Well, in that way, though, the world's people understood the power involved.
Yes. I think very early the understanding of what the potential was correctly publicized. You know, the first time that I had was conscious of it, I was 11 years old. And in school, I gave a little talk on the benefits of nuclear power, which, by the way, I cribbed out of the Saturday Evening Post, and I was most worried about whether I'd memorized it properly than anything else. But still, it gives an idea of the sort of popularity of it at the time. Later on, when I'd gone into engineering and then into physics, it was the... In a sense, idealistic. One had a chance to do something important.
Oh, that's important, all right. Yeah. Very important. So,
yeah.
So you helped put together the Canada's first nuclear reactor. Is that correct?
Well, you gave me a little bit too much credit in the very early things you said. The designer of the Canadian reactor was a wonderful scientist and engineer, W. B. Lewis. My job was to, after I came out of school, to come back to Canada, was to study that reactor, which was under construction,
mm-hmm.
and then be the physicist in charge of bringing the thing into operation.
That's pretty serious.
It was a challenge for a kid my age, and I learned a lot from it. Today, or even a decade after that, you would never have given the essentially a young man like that to that kind of responsibility.
Doctor, that early in all of this, even at that stage, were you as a physicist concerned with what you were doing? In other words, not just the fact that you could create the power and you could cause a chain reaction and do what you were supposed to do, but did you begin thinking at that early stage, I've always wondered about this, about the consequences of it and about the byproducts of it and all the rest of that we're going to have to talk about? Did any of that occur to you that early on?
The principal thing, of course, that bothered one was the use of it as a weapon. It wasn't the waste. It wasn't even that you couldn't solve perfectly adequately the safety of it, of a power reactor.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a crisis of conscience, it was strictly
the weapon part.
The weapons aspect of it.
So you all then weren't thinking too much about the waste aspect of it.
No. Was in fact one of the, as we will get on, I'm sure, later in the program, that was one of the principal weaknesses in the way civilian nuclear was developed, in that it was assumed that if one could make the reactor itself economic. That was the big step, and that the rest that must come along, the processing of the spent fuel and the disposing of the waste, that would come in good time. Hmm. Plenty of time, no hurry with that.
Remember,
that turned out to be a bad misjudgment.
Yes, do you recall early in the interview, a few moments ago, I asked you where you were, and you told me, now let me tell you where I am. I'm in Pahrump, Nevada. That's where I live, in Pahrump.
Rather significant.
So tonight's program is of a fair amount of importance to me. I'm just over the hill and over the dale from Yucca Mountain.
Correct.
And so I guess we'll get to all of that. Nevertheless, what a wonderful job you would have had to be making sure that this thing was going to work. in Canada, were you building reactors the way we built them here in the U.S.? Were they double shielded?
Double contained?
Yes.
No.
Really?
There is a containment of a kind of on the Canadian reactors, but it isn't the one that will take large overpressures that we have on our water reactors here.
Oh, no kidding! Now, when you designed this, Doctor, did you was it in your mind that everything was going to be so backed up and it was going to be done so carefully that nothing could go wrong?
Well, again, let me stress that the Canadian design was done by basically W.B. Lewis and a lot of very good people.
Right.
That it wasn't my
understood
responsibility, although I would have been proud to have done it. The principal argument for building the Canadian heavy water reactors that way was that although things could go wrong, that nothing of a nature to really threaten the fuel integrity. If the fuel doesn't, if the fuel stays intact, there is no accident. We can get into that a little bit, but the fuel is in rods in the reactor,
right?
And it's in either steel or some inert material, metal like that. And as long as the steel clad or the metal clad stays intact, of course there is no accident, no serious accident, no release of radioactivity. And so the principal arguments that the Canadians made and make is that there is no accident that is credible that would affect the fuel to fail the fuel. And over the years, that has turned out to be so.
Has it?
I think it was a pretty good argument.
In Canada or worldwide?
No, in Canada.
In Canada.
In that specific kind of reactor.
Oh,
the
I
Canadian
see.
Kind of reactor is specialized to Canada. It's built one or two other places, but it's fundamentally a Canadian development.
All right, what's different between a Canadian reactor, for example, and a U.S. reactor or a Russian reactor?
Well, the principal reactor that took over the world's generation of electricity is the American light water reactor, so-called.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a reactor that is fundamentally the submarine, the reactor that was developed by Admiral Rickover for the submarine. It's basically that reactor built large.
Okay.
And it has enriched fuel. That is to say that the fissionable material in these reactors starts out to be, in any case, uranium-235, the fissionable isotope of uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And in natural uranium, that's in present only in perhaps 0.75%. The rest is inert. So in the U.S. reactors and the submarine reactors, the enrichment can be 3%, 4%, something like that. Mm-hmm. The point in mentioning that is that in order to build those reactors, you have to have the ability to enrich, precisely what Iran is arguing about right now.
Mm-hmm.
And in Canada, there was no wish to build an enrichment plant, so that they designed reactors that would operate on the natural uranium, the uranium with just 0.75% U-235 content.
So you don't need to enrich it.
So you don't need to enrich. And what that involved was a rather difficult process to use what is called heavy water, a form of water, looks like ordinary water, but does not absorb neutrons like the ordinary water does.
I believe heavy water is used to store spent fuel rods, is it not?
No, you would never use it for that. It's far too expensive.
Oh.
It has to be created through a rather special process.
Okay.
And so to try to pin down the difference then between those two kinds of reactors and then the Russian reactor on the third peg. Let me think for a minute. The Canadian reactors operate, as I said, on natural uranium, and they have a methodology of continuously fueling the thing, whereas the American reactors operate, as I said, with slightly enriched fuel, and they are shut down to refuel. And the Canadian reactors rely on the arguments for safety that we just said. Mm-hmm. The American reactors have heavy containment.
What is the difference in safety when you talk about the Canadian design versus the American? What's the difference? How much difference in safety factor is there?
I would guess not a lot when you added it all up. But I don't think in this country we will ever build reactors without heavy containment.
No, I don't think. In fact, I'm not even sure about continuing to build reactors, period, with any kind of containment.
Yeah. Well, the point is, if you don't, then what alternatives do you have, I guess? And that was the point you were making earlier. But it does depend on what kind of reactors that one builds, obviously, as well. The Russian reactors were of two types, and are of two types. One is very similar to our water reactor. The other is a graphite reactor that was Chernobyl, and that was one of the most primitive early forms of a reactor. It would work, but in my view, it should never have been built as a power-producing reactor.
Uh-huh. How many of these kinds of reactors are still being operated in Russia? Do you know?
Of the order of a dozen.
Oh, my God. And so the original danger is still there times 12, huh?
Well, I think the better way, perhaps, of putting it is that if those reactors are operated with some common sense,
yes,
they'll probably be all right. There have been changes made in them to make them less touchy than they were in 86 when the Chernobyl tragedy happened.
The whole Chernobyl thing is incredible. I had somebody sent me a link once of this young lady who took a motorcycle ride or something through the Chernobyl area. This was fairly recent. And the amount of land now useless, the amount of abandoned homes, and it's just incredible. It is taking that little picture tour of what this young lady saw riding through the Chernobyl.
Yeah.
It was just chilling. The whole thing was big time chilling. How much land is unusable now?
Yes, I don't know the answer to that, but
a lot.
But what you had, yes, a lot. But what you had was the worst possible reactor outcome. Accident. You had the thing wide open to the sky and burning for days on end. It was just revolting.
And, well, a lot of the world thought no such thing could really ever happen until that moment. I mean, I suppose it was, you know, there was some science fiction talk about it, but...
The graphite reactor has its own safety problem. The graphite reactors are built in the earliest days because the materials were cheap and it was fairly simple to do. They're sort of like the Stanley steamer. Well, they would work, but there's a lot better ways of making cars.
Well, while we're on the subject of Chernobyl, where is Chernobyl today? I mean, they put this giant casket thing over it, yes, of concrete, right?
Yes.
So what's going on? Do you know? Do you keep up on it?
I haven't really followed it in recent years. My guess is, for what it's worth, is that that efforts still continue to make sure that the sarcophagus, as it's called, is stable, and that the other reactors on the site are operated to provide the power that is needed in that area. My guess is that's where it is. But
I saw a 60 Minutes piece in which they said the sarcophagus is not at all stable.
It certainly, what I do know is that was always true of it, and it needed to be, reinforced, et cetera, et cetera.
For how long will these protections have to be in place, assuming they hold?
Oh, a very long time.
What do you mean by a very long time?
I would guess unless there is a superhuman effort to clean it up, which
yes,
is certainly possible. But if it's left the way it is,
yes,
you'd have to leave it there for thousands of years.
Thousands of years.
Yes.
All right, Dr. Charles Till, hold tight. We're at the bottom of the hour. And by the way, with respect to the kid of speed thing, the motorcycle thing, whether or not it was a hoax, there are some who say it was a hoax, doesn't change the situation on the ground at Chernobyl. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, what has happened there is, it's very sobering indeed. If you see a report on it, and I've seen various reports on the sarcophagus and the troubles they're having and what their expectations are and the heat building. And, oh, God, what a nightmare, a total nightmare. At any rate, when first creating this reactor in Canada, Dr. Till, there was apparently sort of three periods involved, one of creativity. I don't know. Was the U.S. sharing?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
All right, let me just go on with that, because it's a good way to think about it. In fact, the U.S. is central always in the early days of nuclear development. Every nation looked to the U.S., Canada, the U.K., the European nations, and in fact, if the truth were told, the Soviet Union as well through espionage. But the point really is that for the first 20 years, There was no decision made as to what kind of reactor, would be pursued as the main power generator.
Right.
It was a period when the physicists, to begin with, were sort of in charge. They were king because how do you make nuclear fission work with the various materials? What are the probabilities of this, that, and the other thing? It was an exciting time.
I bet.
Because it was all new, all discoveries. You'd go to the national meetings, as I did, new discoveries, new directions. It was a marvelous time, and that lasted from. Oh, it lasted basically into the mid-60s. In the mid-60s, the first commercial reactor that was offered by a vendor at a guaranteed price that would produce electrical power at an economical, an economical price. When that happened, the second phase of nuclear development that signaled the second phase, and that was one basically of a rush to build, particularly in the U.S. And that lasted from, let's say, 65, 66, somewhere there, to 1974. There were just tremendous numbers of these very large water reactors ordered. 1 year, the peak year, 40 of them were ordered in 1 year. And that was, if one did the calculation, roughly 10% of the whole electrical capacity of the United States at that time.
So the world was hot for it.
Very much so. The utilities wanted it.
Doctor, in retrospect, I mean, for example, right now, we're always having fights over standards, whether it's fighting over standards for high-definition television or whatever it is. We're always having these big fights over standards. In retrospect, was the whole nuclear thing done too quickly? Should there have been some world forum at which there was a standard agreed and accepted, and all of it? Should that have been done?
Well, I think there's no question, or at least there's none in my mind, that in that second period of a rush to build, that all that happened far, far too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That apart from the kind of standards that you're alluding to, which may have been a good idea, but the way I think of it is that the way you develop any technology is you build, you try, you learn, you build on the basis of that learning, and so on. You have a generation after a generation after a generation until finally you perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And there simply wasn't time for that. I think the reactors, well, I know the reactors today, at least in my view, are perfectly adequately safe. There are some 100 of them, as you may know, around the United States at the moment, producing something like 20% of the power.
Mm-hmm.
But the other electrical power. But the other thing that must be said is that at the time in the 70s when those reactors were being built, nuclear power, while convenient, perhaps, wasn't needed in the sense that you are saying, that you're describing how it may be needed in the future.
Hmm.
You know, there's plenty of oil then.
Yes.
Plenty of alternative then.
Yes. How did the price per kilowatt hour, for example, of nuclear power compare to that produced by conventional fuels?
Well, it had to compete, and it did. But that brings me to the next period, which really was from 74 onward, when there were no more orders, because the organized opposition to nuclear simply became too strong, and they, the opponents were able to, through lawsuits and other stratagems, to drive the price of particularly the building of a nuclear plant high enough that no utility would gamble on it.
'Cause it was not a good economic bet any longer, huh?
Well, it wasn't because the construction was never able to proceed without being held up by suits and so on. The reactors that were built, however, were economical, produced power economically, as I say, those 100 of them. And today, of course, because the cost of the building of them has all been amortized, and it's only the operation and the cost of the fuel, which is small, they're tremendous cash generators today.
Then the lawsuits and all of that, even today, remain the reason why more are not being built. Is that fair?
The fear of that, yes. But let me also say, and it'll bring me to the central point that I feel strongly about, and that is that these reactors do not use their fuel efficiently at all. They use less than 1%, closer to 0.5% of the uranium that's actually mined from the ground.
And that results in a very great deal of a waste.
High level waste,
is that right?
It results in what you were referring to in your hometown there.
Uh-huh.
The reactor development that it became clear to me, and I imagine others. But I was in the center of it at Argonne. I'll come to that perhaps if you like in the next while. But it came to me that there were several different characteristics that a successful reactor for the future must have, and they're very simple, very common sense. The first is that you have to have a reactor that uses its fuel efficiently enough that it's worthwhile developing it, that it's going to be the answer for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is that you better have a form of safety that doesn't rely on human operators, because we all make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is that you better have a form of the waste product that isn't so very long-lived, and that people just instinctively rebel against the thought of that you've created something that's a danger for an unimaginably long time.
So who has a reactor that meets all that criteria?
Well, that was the Integral Fast Reactor project at Argonne that I led. That was what we were trying to do. And we had...
Why has it not been done, then?
We had... It's really rather simple. We had for 10 years a very successful project. It involved developing the new fuel, developing the whole thing, the new fuel, the form of safety, and a new process that would allow the fuel to be recycled without increasing the danger of proliferation from processing. And a shorter-lived waste product. We got a long way along all those paths.
So why isn't it currently the reactor being produced in use all over the world?
The whole thing was canceled precipitately in 1994. When the Clinton administration came in, it was announced in the State of the Union address that unnecessary programs are going to be canceled, and in particular, any programs on advanced nuclear energy would be canceled. It took 2 years for them to be able to do that, because Congress, and a Democrat Congress, I might say, was supportive of the project for the reasons that you can imagine.
Yes.
But in the end, and the details of it are really kind of interesting for historical reasons. Put it this way, I have no illusions about the Integral Fast Reactor project being resurrected. That was then. The skilled people who were leading the various parts of it are now gone. The facilities that we used to do the development are now scattered, gone, shut down, and so the principal purpose of us talking about it today is the lessons that are there, and to say the kinds of things that are possible, in fact, with nuclear that are not possible in present nuclear. And we went a long way toward showing what was possible. In the end, the politics ruled, and that was 10 years ago.
And it's remained that way ever since. Well, there have been, though, other administrations that would have been much more friendly to such a obviously important concept as a reactor that would efficiently burn, be economically feasible, and not produce waste. I mean, that's a big concept, Doctor. Why didn't, I don't know, the Reagan administration or one of the other...
Well, the Reagan... Let me try to describe that as objectively as I can. The Reagan administration was pro-nuclear
yes.
Power, but not wildly so. The budgets that they provided were probably 10 or 20% of what they'd been 10 years before, and the prevailing mood in the country was still very much the anti-nuclear, in some senses, actually, for large technologies, anti-technology. The Reagan administration had many different fish to fry, and they were supportive enough that I was able to get this program started in 1985, which in its way was a miracle, because a very large program is needed if you're going to be successful. And to be able to get that started in the mid-80s, I've always been thankful for.
But even after it was killed, I mean, now a lot of years have gone by, Doctor, and
yep.
other administrations have come and gone, and the energy crisis is very apparent today.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is a way to have a safe, productive reactor, then why are we not doing it today?
Well, it should be done. There's no question in my mind that it should be done. And my point really was that we went far enough to show that it probably can be done.
Mm-hmm.
But when that was canceled in 94, I mean, just aside, it was canceled in September of 94. 2 months later, the Republicans swept to power in both houses, and there's no question they would have supported it to completion, which would have taken another 2 or 3 years. There were plenty of Democrats, though, that supported us in Congress, obviously, because we'd had Democrat Congresses through the 10 years of it. But then in the remaining years of the Clinton administration, and that runs us right through to the year 2000, there was no advanced reactor work being done at all. And then in the present administration, some advanced reactor studies are being done, but again, in my view, they're not well directed. So I recognize I'll get an argument with the people that support those programs.
Probably.
But I, in my look, my argument is an extremely simple one. Unless you can develop a form of electrical power that has essentially infinite fuel, nuclear is a very difficult technology, and it probably isn't worthwhile unless it can take a very large portion of the nation and the world's energy needs, service those needs.
Is that, you know, I feel as I listen to you that you do feel that is, it is possible. I mean,
it is possible. There is no question about that. But in order to, in my mind, there's no question about it. But in order to develop that, you have to have the right, I mean, if you're going to develop anything, successfully, you have to have the right goals to begin with, and then a very informed notion as to what kind of technology will meet those goals, and then the will, in fact, to push on and do it. So none of those things are there, in my view, in the present small Department of Energy.
Well, time marches on, Doctor. We're going to break here at the top of the hour. And we're getting more desperate all the time. So, all right, I think it would be useful at this point to find out whether Dr. Till and I agree with regard to the world's current situation. In other words, Dr. Till, right now, we seem to be at a sort of a juncture, perhaps already at that peak oil point, or if we're not at it, then we're close to it, and we can see down the tunnel a little ways where it is. Peak oil meaning, you know, we're pumping as much as we're ever going to be pumping, and we're going to pump at that level, or it's going to begin to decline. And it seems to me that as we decline, awful things are going to begin to happen, like, the price of gasoline rising to the point that people can't go to work anymore. Wars will occur for access to what little is left, that sort of thing. That's the future that I see as a probable one. How do you read it?
I can't see any reason to think otherwise. The only question is, of course, when does that peak come?
Mm.
I think the more frightening thing, as you said, than the price of gasoline going up is the absolute certainty of warfare over the remaining resources.
If it
comes to that, unless there is an alternative, unless there are realistic alternatives.
I'm not even sure it's not happening right now. Aside for a second.
Yes.
I've had for years doing this kind of program, Doctor, I've had emails, communications from people making claims that they've got some box, some technological development that they've made, that some magic black box, and you put in a little bit of power and out comes a lot of power. In other words, free energy or something very close to free energy. As a physicist, I'm sure that you've looked at a lot of these things, and I would like to tap your knowledge and just know if you are aware of anything out there that even approaches reality in this area. Is there any black box out there or technology you're aware of that'll come along and save us?
Art, I was in charge of the reactor program at Argonne. There were some 2,000 people there for, as you said, 20 years. I would guess every month for those 20 years, I had at least one, sometimes half a dozen, proposals sent to me to comment on and hopefully support for everything from perpetual motion to the kind of magic device that would take energy and without any further input of energy increase the amount of energy at the output. Various people who proposed to have by radio waves reduce the radioactivity of substance and so on. I mean, all of these just defeat the laws of physics. And just flatly the answer to your question is no, there is none.
There is none.
There is none. Look, it's energy is a big industrial commodity. It has to meet the common sense criterion. And oil today carries such a heavy load. Now, in the United States, and I imagine it's true in any developed country, the split in the way energy is used is roughly one-third, one-third, one-third. One-third goes to electricity, one-third goes to transportation, one-third goes to heating and industrial processes.
Okay.
So there is some, ability to substitute back and forth across those lines. But if you're going to really make any kind of an impact on oil and gas, you have to install huge amounts of electrical capacity. Electricity will substitute for almost anything. And so that's the way to go. But there aren't alternatives. You know, wind, small amount. Solar, small amount.
Would you continue to maintain small amount, even if there was a gigantic effort made and giant wind farms were placed and solar farms here in the Southwest where all of those commodities are readily available, is still only a dent?
It would still only be a dent. And whether, you know, it depends on what one's idea of an attractive landscape is. But take wind, for example. It's unreliable. It's unsightly. It produces only small amounts of power per unit, requiring lots and lots and lots of land. It's a hard way to go. I would certainly support any development along those lines.
Well,
one isn't going to make a dent in the requirement.
Okay. Well, that's the overall important point. However, here in the American Southwest, we have a great deal of unused BLM government land, which is not going to turn anybody's head because of the ugly wind generators or the solar panels that might be pointed toward the sky. I mean, there is a lot of farming that could be done out here. And I'm sure you support at least that being done, don't you?
Of course I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
Or any other realistic alternative. You know, and the people talk about the tides and this that, and the other thing. But one thing one must keep in mind, and in any of this, as an engineer, in order to produce large amounts of energy, you have to have a source of energy that is fairly where the original energy from the sun has been gathered, and that's in coal, for example, and oil and gas in the fossil things. It's gathered there. It's concentrated. The engineer can get it released in large amounts with fairly simple processes. With nuclear, it's even more concentrated.
Let's go back to that for 1 second. As I mentioned to you, I live in Pahrump, Nevada now.
Mm-hmm.
If you, it's great to wish that your project had gotten off the ground. We'd built many of those reactors, but it didn't happen.
Sure.
And we are faced today with a reality because of the kind of reactors that we have in this country. And that reality is all of this waste material, high-level waste material that I understand tens of thousands of years will pass and we'll have to store it safely in Yucca Mountain or wherever it is we end up putting it. If you were the man in charge here in the U.S. of the problem of nuclear waste, what would you do? Assuming you had, you could just issue an edict as a physicist and say, here's what we're going to do, what would you do?
If I had the power to do that, I suppose I would have the funds in order to implement it.
That's
look,
right, yes.
The suspension in the 70s of reprocessing was part of the effort to close down nuclear power. Reprocessing would have given a waste form that mm-hmm. would have been much more compact, much easier, and if the reprocessing was done properly, to have a lower-lived waste. And more than that, you wouldn't be burying a material that 99 point, well, in the material you're burying, it's more like 96% of it is still perfectly useful for energy.
What would have, could have, that's done. And
right. What would I do now?
That's the question.
There isn't in the present circumstance, there isn't any alternative. If you're going to have the nuclear power and you're not going to have processing, there is no alternative but to bury it in Yucca Mountain or somewhere else. It can't stay in the storage pools around the reactors forever. So the, you know, like many other things in our lives, the decisions made 30 years ago, we're paying for.
Yes. How long will we have to be careful stewards of that material once we get it buried wherever it's going?
Well, the long-lived elements in there are the so-called man-made elements, not the fission products. And the long-lived ones, and the reason that you're one's concerned about them principally is that in addition to being very long-lived, they can, if the water drainage is suitable to it, you can contaminate water supplies in some distant time.
How long, Doctor?
Hundreds of thousands of years, basically.
Hundreds of thousands of years?
Yeah. These things are very long-lived.
What I was going to ask
my point is that they should not really be buried.
Yeah, I've got that. Yeah, but you also said we have no choice.
Well, there's no such program, and there's no prospect of a program.
All right, Doctor, I once saw a Good Morning America, and they had this most remarkable demonstration on. I'm sure you probably heard about it. And they took some high-level waste, or a little tiny bit of it, and they, in the period of 15 or 20 minutes, did some process and reduced, normally it would have a half-life of, as you just mentioned, longer than we can imagine. It just knocked down the radiation, apparently, so quickly. It was on Good Morning America. Did you ever hear about that?
I never saw that, no? And I can't fathom what would have been done.
I've always wondered, because I never heard anything after that demonstration that I thought was incredible. So,
yeah, well, it is incredible. it isn't possible in the way we're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, again,
the thing you could do, of course, is have a simple process, as we did with our IFR reactor,
uh-huh.
to separate the long lived ones from the shorter lived ones, and just. And just deal then with the shorter lived ones in a repository that you would have every confidence that would last the few tens or hundreds of years that would be required before they decayed away to levels similar to the original uranium.
Well, man has never done anything for hundreds of thousands of years.
No, of course not. Hundreds of years, yes. Churches, all kinds of things, but of course.
Yes. Hundreds of thousands of years.
Of course. I mean, it's unimaginable, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, actually. Totally unimaginable.
Yeah.
And if there's not an earthquake now, there will be one later.
Yeah.
And if there's not some other form of tragedy now, there will be one later. There could be a rock from space that would... I mean, if all of this stuff that they're going to stuff in the ground, Doctor, got exposed... either into a water table or got exposed to the air by accident, what would the likely results be?
Well, the result would be one that you would it would vary. Look, I've worked with a lot of radioactivity over the years, and when the let's talk about spent fuel. When the spent fuel first comes out of the reactor, it's very hot indeed, very radioactive. You don't want to be standing by it.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't take very many weeks before most of that dies away. The very long-lived material is not very radioactive. In other words, in order for it to harm a human, I mean, you can stand by it. In fact, you can pick it up in your hands. I've done that in experiments. The very long life stuff has to be ingested as you would ingest arsenic or something else, that heavy metal like that would harm you.
You see, that's why I was asking about water tables.
Yeah, and that is exactly right. It would have to be in the water or the air, and you'd have to ingest it either in your lungs or whatever, very similar to any other heavy metal. Ingesting radium, ingesting, and so on. But as far as the danger in standing by it is concerned, that's confined to the first, I don't know, 100, 200, 300 years, something like that.
I see.
Which I don't think is generally appreciated. I'm not sure how important that is.
Well, it's fairly important to me,
yeah.
Actually.
Because that's what we tried to do with the IFR. And each of the things I mentioned, but let me stay to the waste. The waste, we wanted to have simply fission product, simply the fission product. And what that meant was, as I said, in perhaps 300 years, or depending on one or two things, but in a few hundred years, 300, 500, 200, whatever, that the activity would have dropped to the same level as the original uranium when it was mined, which was just a criterion we used to say, well, that's pretty good.
Pretty good. Can IFR be restarted? Can it? I mean, today, for example, could that whole process begin, and we could start building reactors?
We are the short answer is no. The longer answer, the short answer is no, because, as I said, the facilities, the people, have been scattered to the winds since.
But ideas.
You can say there are other people, other facilities.
But ideas don't die.
Ideas don't die.
People
no.
move. People
will this,
die.
Will this kind of technology eventually be adopted? I don't think there's any doubt about it. But will it be done in this country? Not under the present environment. Let me talk about the safety for a second, just because we were talking a lot about Chernobyl. In the test reactor, the IFR test reactor that we operate here in Idaho, we carried out the same accident that about 2 or 3 weeks later happened at Chernobyl in our test reactor to show that it would shut itself down without humans doing anything. Or
that'd be loss of coolant.
It was loss of coolant. It was shutting off the coolant pumps.
Just shutting them off.
Just shutting them off and letting the and no control rods going in, nothing. Letting the materials that the reactor was made of.
And in the IFR test reactor, what happened?
Nothing. It just shut itself down. And in the afternoon, we started the reactor up again. And if you recall the Three Mile Island accident, what happened there was that the heat from the reactor was unable to be transferred to the electrical system, and so the reactor just heated itself up. We did exactly the same thing in the IFR test that afternoon. Once again, the reactor just shut itself down. We were sure it would by gradually working up to that and by calculation. But it was a remarkable demonstration. Those were the two accidents. One had happened before, one happened after. We did those tests. It was kind of interesting. There was a science reporter in the Wall Street Journal, Bishop, Jerry Bishop, who had the experience going back to the early days of nuclear. And the kind of press release that the Department of Energy put out, which was kind of opaque, Jerry was smart enough to realize what this was when Chernobyl happened. He realized that this was exactly the same as the Chernobyl thing that we had done in Idaho about two weeks before.
All right, Doctor, hold it right there. We're here at the bottom of the hour. Dr. Charles Till is my guest, and I know to a lot of you, nuclear energy is sort of magic, and you don't understand it. This will be your night to be able to ask questions of somebody who does know the real story. All right, once again, Dr. Charles Till. Dr. Till, as I mentioned there, most Americans have sort of a vague fear, or maybe not so vague, of nuclear power, with some good cause, bearing in mind what's happened in the world with it. Although I understand that on the safety side of it, people can cite statistics of the number of kilowatt hours produced and all the rest of it, and we've only had one major accident and a few minor ones. But nevertheless, they have a kind of a fear of nuclear energy and don't understand a lot about it. So I'd like to be able to let them ask some questions. Ross of Minneapolis, Minnesota, has a real good one that he blasted to me on the computer here. It says, ask the doctor, please, about fusion power and where we are with fusion now. I've sort of vaguely heard things about it in the experimentation going on. What would fusion be as compared to what we have now?
Well, first of all, there is the principal difference in my mind between fusion and fission reactors is that we know how to build the fission reactors. The fusion work is still in the R&D stage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not skeptical about eventually being able to make fusion work, although magnetic fusion does require a very large facility with the knowledge we have today, and I doubt very much if the power would be close to economic. Fusion is not as clean as people, clean of radioactivity as people might think just offhand. The material that the fuel material is tritium, which is an interestingly radioactive material itself, and the all of the materials of construction get pretty heavily irradiated. So there is some element of waste to consider there too. Not on the scale, of course, of fission. Mm-hmm. So I guess to summarize, where I think it is that it hasn't been proven. It isn't something that you could point to rely on, but work almost certainly should continue on it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take some questions from the audience. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What is your first name?
My name's Chris.
Okay, Chris, what's up?
Yeah, I had two questions, and I hope I got the right name right. In the 1920s, there was a big experience done. I think it was Marconi. I'm not sure if I got the right name, but he built a huge energy source.
Okay, I think you mean Tesla.
Tesla, right. And he did this huge energy experience, but he couldn't control it, so he was shut down. And I was going to ask about that, and then also I was going to ask about what he thought about hydrogen power.
All right. Let's take both questions. Thank you very much. First of all, Tesla, doctor, there's all kinds of rumors and lore about what Tesla did and did not do. Have you ever looked into the life of Tesla?
No, I haven't. I feel I think a little bit the way you describe it. It sounds like it's interesting, but it's kind of puzzling. I think I can answer the first part of it very honestly and very directly, and that is that I know so little about it that any comment I might make would be perfectly would not be useful.
Good answer.
The second part of it,
hydrogen.
Hydrogen, I think, is more straightforward. Something that, again, I'm not an expert on, but I, people that.
All right. Well, the Bush administration has pretty much forwarded the concept of hydrogen as the rather immediate answer to our problems. They're proceeding along a hydrogen path. Good idea or not?
Well, it's a good idea, but for the immediate future, no. Look, the problems with hydrogen are fairly simple.
And they are?
They are that it's difficult to store. It's not, the first thing that you worry about with hydrogen, of course, is getting some oxygen there and getting a very loud bang. But as an engineering matter, it takes energy to make hydrogen. The reason that you'd make hydrogen is to use it in for transportation. Of course, you don't gain energy by.
That was the important question, and that's what I've heard others say that mm-hmm. That you have to use energy to create and then to store the right. hydrogen.
Right.
And so it's not like a net gain. It's not like the sort of free thing or...
No.
Free is a bad word, but even close to free thing that... Or a replacement thing.
Right. Well, look at it this way. Hydrogen is made from water. And the way the hydrogen is burned, it makes water back again. So it's clean, and I mean, clean burning in the sense that the combustion product is water. But you have had to expend energy to split the water to begin with into hydrogen, and then of course you use it, as I said, to produce the energy. And so the purpose of it is to make your electrical energy portable.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me throw another big barb at you and see how you do with it. Well, what we have been doing and are doing now is expending fossil fuels. In the process of expending fossil fuels, a great deal is ejected into the atmosphere by the cars we drive and the factories we run. And there are many who now feel that what's been ejected into the atmosphere is beginning to affect our Earth in terms of warming it and melting the North Pole and the South Pole and affecting our climate. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yes. In the job I had all kinds of presentations of things, and the early studies on global warming by CO2. I had presentations made there, both at the laboratory and the university, by the scientists that were doing it, and I studied their papers. What there is no question about in my mind is, and the evidence is absolutely clear, the carbon dioxide component of the atmosphere is going up steadily year by year.
Yes.
What isn't as obvious is whether that really is having any effect on the temperatures around the world. Every climate environmentalist will say, well, we've had a half a degree in the last 50 years or something like that, and which is, although those measurements are difficult to make, I accept them. On the other hand, in the previous 50 years, there was probably half a degree of cooling. So it isn't, in my view, as absolutely clear as the way it's being used in the political situation, particularly internationally. It is not clear in my mind. On the other hand, there are other things that are, acid rain and so on and so on.
Yes.
Those things just have to be taken care of.
Yes. What does seem clear, though, is that about 40% of the polar ice is gone in the last 50 years, you mentioned, and... down south, we're getting a lot of calving. The Ross Ice Field may or may not be stable. There are indications now that it may not be as stable as they thought it was. And, of course, that would be serious trouble because that ice is all on land. Should it melt or slide, why, the ocean levels would get very unacceptably high with not good results.
No, of course not. And the question is whether that's man-made.
Yes, that is. What's your feeling?
Well, I feel that the models, having looked at the papers, the computer models that they use are very sensitive to their assumptions, and I would find it hard to really accept the results. My own, reading about this over the last several centuries, as you know from your very informed comment there, that there are large swings in the average temperature over the year simply due to the effects of sun and sunspots and so on, ice ages, little ice ages, and so on. And whether the current tendency toward warming is man-made, that is, the link has not been shown to me in my mind.
Well, I wonder if they'll discover and affirm that link any faster than they did the link between cancer and tobacco.
Well, of course, you make a good point.
We stumbled over that one for a long time.
when it was an absolutely direct link, in fact.
Well, I do recall the cigarette CEOs sitting in front of a congressional or Senate inquiry saying, no, it's not addictive.
Right.
No, it's not addictive.
Right. But by the mid-70s, it was clear it was not just a statistical, it was a direct link.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of carbon dioxide, I don't think you could make that case yet myself. And I'm saying that as one who, supports the use of nuclear power as broadly as is possible, and clearly using the thought that carbon dioxide in the air is going to be harmful to the climate makes the case, or partially makes the case for nuclear.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Charles Till. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Art. This is Ahab, listening on the Big 89 out of Chicago, calling
yes.
from South Bend. Well, Dr. Till, and first off, I just want to say I still have a big smile on my face. Thanks for the feedback on Ann, because, you know, you put those prayers out there, and you know, sometimes you wonder what happens, you know?
Well, there you are, sir.
So I'm still smiling about that. I'm
good.
Glad to hear the good news.
Good.
And, Doctor, I got to say thank you for all the good work that you tried to do and in enlightening people about the truth about nuclear industry. I mean, most people don't understand the history of the marketplace and what happened and how, you know, with the oil crisis kind of fueled that rush to market, you know, with the second and third generation designs
right.
that really became like the industry standard when they never should have been. And it's kind of soured everybody on the entire industry. And, I mean, if they, you know, and I, honest to God, I am maybe a terminal optimist, but I think that the work that you guys did, it will come to light sooner or later. You know, they're going to have to mothball. These things are all going to run their, you know, life cycle. And sooner or later, we can't just write off 20% of our electrical generating power
mm-hmm.
capacity. They're going to have to, you know, go back and reexamine the work you did. It will come back to light.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of time, and thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that.
Ed, but my big question, I guess, for you is, I know coming from your background, you're thinking like big centralized production. But when you look at the alternatives and maybe the other uses of nuclear energy, don't you think that the real answers are all in decentralized power production?
Well, I recognize the argument there, but... the thing that one always fights against, of course, is that you do get tremendous economies with scale, as you well know.
Right,
and,
right. But for a certain percentage of that we need to generate, we do need those economies of scale just because
mm-hmm.
of the way we live and organize our society.
Mm-hmm. But, precisely so.
But for the vast other sections of the energy that we use for heating and transportation, we don't need that centralized power.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, that's by its nature, the way we use it in our homes and in our vehicles and in transportation is all decentralized. And I can only, I guess in my mind, I think of all the brain power and all the huge financial resources that have been kind of thrown at the energy market in all sectors. And if just a fraction of even went into what, you know, into oil exploration or nuclear, you know, research had gone into somehow figuring out how to make use of that big, bad nuclear reactor in the sky, you know, that's perfectly decentralized, utterly predictable. It's a nice, safe standoff distance.
All right, well,
and very diffuse, unfortunately.
Yes.
If you can stand outside, you know, the way I explained it to my kids was that if you can stand outside and turn your palm up to the sky and simply feel the heat of the sun, that means that you're going to have a considerable amount of effort gathering up enough of that heat to really be useful. Clearly, you can heat homes, particularly in the south. Clearly, you can dry grain, all of these things. Clearly, you can produce some electricity, but it's a difficult business.
Dr. Till, let me take a leap forward in this area. The sun, sure, it all comes one way or the other
mm-hmm.
from the sun. And as you point out, it's concentrated in the fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. But there is this new idea that people are churning around that in combination with nanotechnology,
mm-hmm.
a gathering place in space, in orbit, could be achieved, and power could be collected very efficiently in a geosynchronous sort of orbit, I guess, and then transferred to Earth stations by satellite. What do you have you looked at that at all?
No, I haven't. I've had those kinds of suggestions made, of course. The sort of common sense reaction that I generally have is, well and good, collecting it there. How are you proposing to get huge amounts of power down to the Earth's surface?
Microwave.
If you're going to do that way, I wouldn't want to stand in front of the beam.
No, wouldn't be advised.
Wouldn't be advised.
But
so these things may be possible. I don't really know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Again, fair enough. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello.
Good evening, or should I say good morning, Dr. Till, and good morning, Art.
Good morning, sir. You're not too strong. You're going to have to yell at us a little.
No problem. This is Greg from WABC in New York.
Yes, sir.
And my question is about the use of nuclear power with military vehicles, in particular nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. The world's first aircraft carrier, nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, the USS Enterprise, is due for decommission in 2013. Does Dr. Till have any idea as to some best practices to decommission a carrier that's as big as the Empire State Building and has eight reactors?
Yeah, interesting question.
It is an interesting question, and again, my short answer is no. It's not anything that I've ever looked at, and I want to try to be a little bit careful about what I know and saying what I know and what I don't know.
Okay.
But no, I'm sorry. I just don't know.
Do you, in your professional opinion, how do you feel about the use of reactors at sea going into war?
There's an awfully good question, Doctor.
Well, we have a very considerable submarine fleet, as you well know.
Nuclear powered, yes.
Submarine fleet. I suppose the question is directed at, well, all right, but what happens if these surface vessels or submarine vessels are attacked and destroyed?
I'll tell you what, Doctor. Hold that thought. But reactors going into battle is a very, very interesting question. My guest is Dr. Charles Till, and we'll jump right on that one when we get back. I'm Art Bell. By the way, quick note for the audience. Tomorrow night begins a unique process that we do once a year in which we allow the audience, particularly the talented members of the audience, to make a prediction for the year upcoming, in this case 2005. Now, I have the list, the carefully protected list of numbered predictions. It's the only time of the year we allow this, and we actually number the predictions as you make them. And I'm asking that my audience, as I did last year, with good effect, I might add, actually not just dial and call, but take a moment between now and tomorrow night, and then again on the 31st, I'm going to be off for the Christmas holiday. So we'll have two nights. That would be tomorrow night and the 31st for you to register your predictions. Don't do it lightly. Think very carefully about it, and if you have a talent for seeing the future, then use it between now and when you make your prediction. At any rate, we'll be up to that tomorrow night. Now, once again, Dr. Charles Till, and the question was with respect to reactors and going to war. Certainly in a war situation, it would be possible that a reactor on a nuclear sub or an aircraft carrier or wherever we use them in the military these days could be itself blown up. And so the obvious question on behalf of those who live in the world would be, what effect would there be, likely?
Well, and the answer, I'm sure, varies with whose nuclear navy we're talking about. Look, the nuclear navy, our own nuclear navy, is almost a nation to itself. And what the designs are of the reactors, how much shielding they have, and so on, all of that is classified, and it isn't anything I've ever made a study of. The advantage, obviously, of using nuclear is that you can go literally years without going back to port for refueling.
Yes.
The obvious question that the listener asks, I don't know the answer to. I would hope that they're extremely well shielded, but I simply don't know.
Yes,
the designs are not published.
Yes, well, even that in mind, Doctor, take a nuclear submarine as an example. As well shielded as it may be, a nuclear submarine could, in a war, encounter a nuclear detonation close by, and close by enough to virtually vaporize the nuclear submarine. And so the question is, what environmental effect would we possibly realize should that opening occur?
Sure. My own guess is that the nuclear explosion that caused the submarine to it would probably be the very much larger effect of the two. But
okay.
But
it would add.
You would add some. I suppose some small amount to it. But what has happened with the Russian nuclear submarines? There's one or two, as you know, have been lost, so-called.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of them in port that need the reactors removed, and those things are going on, again, with U.S. help. But the whole subject of the nuclear navy, the use of reactors is not one that I specialized in at all.
And it's all classified?
And it's classified
okay.
Up and down the line, even the core designs are.
All right. Well, here's a good question for you. You're certainly familiar with when we and others built reactors early on.
Mm-hmm.
I think the psychology at that time was, let's see if we can build a reactor that's economically feasible and safe.
Correct.
Now, when we were thinking about safe in those days,
mm-hmm.
I don't think we were thinking a whole lot about a guy with a shoulder-fired, armor-piercing missile in his hand shooting at one of the containments.
Mm-hmm.
But today we are thinking about that
mm-hmm.
Because we have no shortage of people apparently willing to give their lives in an effort to kill lots of us.
Mm-hmm.
So if a person had a shoulder-fired, armor-piercing missile and was firing at a containment, what would the probable outcome be? Or would it bounce off the containment?
I don't know. I can tell you that that in addition to the containment, once you're inside the containment, you're looking at least 7 feet of reinforced concrete between that and the the reactor core, at least 7 feet.
7 feet.
Of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's just there for shielding purposes, but it is also an extremely strong structure.
Something that could, for example, withstand a 747.
Well, yes. The thing that you would worry about there is the engines. But again, the studies that were done while I was still reasonably active said that the shielding
would hold up,
withstand those.
Well, that may be the answer then. You know, when 9/11 occurred, Doctor,
mm-hmm.
it was said that the terrorists actually flew over a couple of nuclear power plants to get planes down to New York and to the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be the answer to why they didn't do what people wondered why they didn't do. In mm-hmm. other words, they knew they could not have done it.
Well, I think I think they're far better off for the effect that they're wanting to achieve. Hitting it's a not a very pleasant thing to say, but hitting the large buildings—they're a big target.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, and secondly, they're certainly not protected like the cores of nuclear reactors.
Mm-hmm. Okay, get good and close to the phone. It's getting a little tough to hear
you. Yeah. Okay.
That's good. That's much.
There
better.
Was one additional point that I wanted to make on the IFR on the waste part of it.
Yes.
And that is in addition to separating the usable material from the inert material that makes up makes up the bulk of the stuff that's going into Yucca Mountain. In addition to that, you want to be able to, of course, get rid of the long-life stuff. So you want a kind of reactor that will burn that up.
Right.
And that, again, is the kind of reactor that we were designing. It would use the americium, the neptunium, and curium equally well to plutonium or uranium-235, produce power, and be gone.
Well, you see, Doctor, I'm not a physicist, and I sit here and I listen to you, and you tell me about IFR, and you virtually are telling me this is the answer, you know, to our problems, and you really haven't offered me anything yet in terms of a reason why it's not being used right now, except stupidity. So is there any...
No, but I would put it very directly. The IFR, while in those 10 years, while we were still at a point where it was not at all clear that we could achieve the kinds of things we were talking about, was not attacked by the anti-nuclear, organized anti-nuclear people.
When we got
close enough, then the attack really, really started.
I see.
And when with the best will in the world, when the Clinton administration came in, it brought in a lot of very anti-nuclear folks whose life had been devoted to
yes.
to fighting it. And the IFR obviously is aimed at a long-term nuclear energy source, and that's exactly what they did not want. And so, it's a case of saying, well, what was wrong with the technology?
All right. Well, I was about to ask that. What did the anti-nuclear people say was the hole in IFR?
The principal argument was similar to the argument on reprocessing, and that is to say that it would add to the proliferation risk. My response is perfectly straightforward, and that is that none of the IFR processes would allow you to even approach pure enough plutonium to, with any facility, make any kind of a nuclear weapon. That's not the way any fledgling nation, any terrorist group or anything would go. They would go the way that it is guessed that Iran is trying to go, and that is through the enrichment of uranium process, because those bombs are fairly easy to make. But to try to make a bomb out of material that is composed of all the isotopes of plutonium, plus curium, plus neptunium, plus americium, one of our very sophisticated national laboratories in this country might be able to do it. But that's the kind of expertise that it would be required.
You mentioned Iran a number of times. Iran is saying very strongly that why they don't want a bomb and what they're doing is not not headed in that direction. Are they lying?
What would you guess?
Oh, well,
the point is that for a country that's sitting on a large fraction of the oil reserves in the world, why would you want a nuclear power plant? And in particular, why would you want a nuclear power plant that has along with it the enrichment processes that would be required if you were to fuel the plant yourself, but would also allow you to take the enrichments up to where they would be weapons usable? To me, the only reason that a nation that oil rich would be looking at that would be if they have that at least in the back of their mind.
Mm-hmm. That would have been my guess.
Sure.
Wildcard line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello.
Hey, I'm just wondering. A quick history of plutonium. How was it discovered? Is it natural? Is it engineered?
Plutonium.
Plutonium?
Yes.
Oh, yes, that's an easy one. Plutonium is a man-made in the sense that it's made in reactors by simply uranium absorbing a neutron and not fissioning it. After a short time, that product decays to plutonium, and that's what you've got. The main isotope of plutonium has a half-life of about 25,000 years. The material itself looks like a metal like any other. I've, as I said to people lots of times, picked up over the years tons of it in gloved hands. It's not the main isotope's not particularly radioactive, particularly dangerous. It's it's comparable maybe to radium.
Mm-hmm.
And its chemical toxicity, it's like any other heavy metal, lead or arsenic or anything else, it's got chemical toxicity. But once you've made the stuff, it's not much different than any other heavy metal, as far as its appearance and properties are concerned.
Mm-hmm. How concerned are you about proliferation?
Oh, very. Absolutely. How could one not be?
Yes. North Korea, it is said now, may have as many as 3 bombs or more and be producing more.
Conceivable, sure.
Yes. Uh-huh. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm calling from Toronto, Canada.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like to say that my family feel very comfortable. Like I grew up out in Rouge Hill, and there's a couple of plants out there. And, you know, the real estate value for an average starter home is like $320,000.
Right.
We used to yacht out and swim and, you know, feeling very confident because, like, they're fortresses and they're very secure environments.
Right.
Planes are, a plane could crash into it. It's got all kinds of shutdown systems and it has cooling systems.
Right.
And
right.
Everyone's confident. I mean, I think that in a free world, in a democratic society, right, that, you know, we have no problem, or at least people that we can have faith in, right, to be able to govern such a...
Good, I agree with you.
Such a, you know, an advancement in science. But, you know, we are concerned, and, you know, as Canadians, right, we certainly wouldn't be involved or engage with anyone that's questionable. And, you know, I'm a proven, you know, like I've swam in that water and, you know, as they say, you know, like it's a vibrant, like we camp out there.
Of course.
And, you know, we're very confident and we're, you know, and my old aunt was a chemical buyer for one of the uranium mines and she told me that she was very confident herself, right? So, you know, we're calm and, you know, like our family has tons of real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're confident investing in those areas. And
well, caller, you know, I'd like to say that I'm confident, but I'm admitting that I don't know enough about it to be confident. In other words, even scientifically, I'm not aware of enough of it to feel confident. And I think a lot of Americans and Canadians share that point of view simply because they don't understand the process itself, and frankly, they've seen some mistakes made, and that has a way of undermining the confidence of people when they see a mistake made. Doctor, how do you react to that?
Well, I react, I suppose, this way. I agree very much with the Canadian caller. I wouldn't mind living, the rest of my lifetime or all of my lifetime sitting right beside either a Canadian or American or any Western nation nuclear plant. The accident, the sole accident that we've had in the kind of water reactors, either heavy or light water reactors, is the Three Mile Island accident. And
right.
It's never been proven to my satisfaction that anyone was harmed from that.
Well, all right, then. Here's a counter argument. To some of that, and it comes from Don in Glendale, who says, why is the nuclear industry so damn secretive? Why don't they tell us the truth? Why hide meltdowns like the one, his words now, in 1958 in the mountains between Simi Valley and San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, was a total meltdown of a reactor. I don't know if that's true or not. I have no way of knowing. But the nuclear industry is somewhat secretive, Dr. Till, and that's another thing that sort of undermines some of the confidence.
Well, I think that's a very justified criticism for the earlier days. I mean, I would make very much the same criticism for. I'm unfamiliar with the particular reactor that he's talking about. It might have been the sodium graphite reactor. But there were so many reactors built in that period that mm-hmm. was the research and development period, the first 20 years. All different kinds. Try this out, try that out. And when one talks about melting the core of one of those small reactors, it's far, far different than, of course, an accident to a Three Mile Island or a Chernobyl size. There were, in those early days, there were many melting, not meltdowns particularly, but melting of fuel in test reactors. There were some test reactors that were built expressly for that purpose. To see what would happen.
You do agree the industry is awfully secretive.
Well, I wouldn't agree with it today, but I do agree with it very much. Like in Idaho here, there was a reactor in 1960, SL1 it was called.
Hold the thought on SL1. Sure. We're at the bottom. And once again, Dr. Charles Till, and you were beginning to tell us about a reactor, I think, close to you?
Yeah, it was in Idaho in 1960. It was, in fact, happened just after I got back from England, and I was in Canada. It was announced by the Atomic Energy Commission that there had been a chemical explosion on the reactor site out here. For reasons that I still feel puzzled about, because what it was a small Army reactor that had exploded, killed four of the four workers at night. There was some evidence that, in fact, that two workers were deadly enemies and one had used it as a method of, in essence, a murder-suicide. But
I see.
But it. But the puzzling thing was, why on earth not just say what it was?
Well, I don't know. You know, an interesting.
But today, Art, it's different. I mean, you can. In anybody that has access in every library probably has them. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission reports, you can get every detail of the operation of present-day reactors, and that's been true for some 25 years, probably.
I see, yes. Well, I'm going to be 60 years old this coming June, and I lived in a place called Blue Ridge Summit, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
That's right on the Pennsylvania-Maryland border.
Uh-huh.
And by golly, that's where I was when Three Mile Island happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we were all totally freaked out.
Sure.
But I can tell you this, Doctor. The radio and television stations that were relaying information to us, those of us who were near the plant or even relatively near the plant,
mm-hmm.
were lying.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness, were they lying.
Mm-hmm.
So the official word was an absolute lie. I mean, there was no significant problem. It was a very minor, nothing to worry about. They were lying.
Yes.
And, see, that's what contributes to this, you know, this.
There's two comments. Yes, I agree with you, and I'm in total sympathy with what you said, because I watched it on television, too, just like you did.
Well, there you are.
Without the fear, because I guess I wasn't close to it. But the first thing to be said is that they weren't sure. They didn't know what happened.
Mm.
And there's no excuse for that. They did not have the level of technical scientific knowledge present in that plant, and that's freely admitted today.
Hmm.
And I can remember also just reading the minutes of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission meeting on that, and there was one of the commissioners who was technical, who was in fact the lead commissioner, and the others were, I don't know, lawyers, whatever they were. And one of them said, "Tell us what's happening, Joe."
Yes.
You know, the point is that it's a point I'm making earlier, and that is that I believe nuclear is absolutely as safe as any large power source can be. If it's properly operated, properly designed, properly operated, but it's got to be operated with discernment.
But what you just told us is that it wasn't properly.
That is correct.
Operated.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. So that makes it a pretty big if. Or was that then, and this is now, and then it wasn't, and now it is.
Yes, is the answer. Now is much different. Now the. Plants are generally speaking operated by companies who have made it their business to operate them properly with a strong regulatory commission overlooking them and so on. I have no, I have no fear of that kind of that low technical judgment being exercised in our plants or Canadian plants or
gotcha.
You know, Western Europe.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hi.
Good afternoon, Art, or good morning or something like that. First time caller, long time listener.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Dr. Till.
Good afternoon.
Good evening, something like that. My question, Dr. Till, is concerning recently with the media. They have had reports of, you know, these, there's been concern about dirty bombs, and they did a report from Petersburg how easy it is to obtain nuclear materials. How much of a, I mean, how much, has anybody approached you about this, and how much of a threat is it to the general public?
Okay, it's
well,
a good question.
Generally speaking, what they're talking about when they're talking about dirty bombs, I think, is the use of medical, an explosive with medical isotopes. That they've gathered up and used that to
or worse
to fear, but you can't getting back to Art's point earlier, what would happen to you if you stood next to a spent fuel element? A spent fuel element would be a very poor choice. It would very likely very likely kill the person who's trying to deliver the bomb as opposed to. They have a lot of scattering it about.
Yeah, they have lots of disposable people for that. They prove that on a daily basis.
Well,
and I think
he wouldn't be able to drive the truck. I suppose I don't know. I really don't know. I don't take the dirty bomb scenario. I think there are much much better ways of.
I think the main point of a dirty bomb is psychological, not real, and it would work. I mean, there would be.
Well, there'd be some, depending on what you have for your radioactive material.
Because of what we're talking about this morning, since people don't understand what you understand about the nature of radioactive material, mm-hmm. they would just hear bomb, and they'd hear nuclear, and that'd be that. There'd be absolute panic, and that's exactly what they'd be doing it for. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question about disposing of the nuclear waste. I don't know if it's feasible or not, and by no means am I a litter bug, but would it be feasible to, like, put it on the moon launch it to the sun?
The sun, yes. This is my favorite question, Dr. Till. People like this gentleman who think that perhaps it might be all right to load it all on a rocket and launch it into the sun, or perhaps in onto the moon, or whatever.
You hear that from time to time.
You do.
Don't you? But
yes.
But if it's not safe to bury in a mountain, why would it be safe to put on a rocket?
And occasionally, rockets seem to blow up.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, so
you'd
really have it. I mean, you'd have this real high-level waste, and you'd be launching it, and would get up into the atmosphere.
You would have a classic dirty bomb, I think.
Yeah, you'd have.
No, I don't think it's a
bad idea.
An idea that should
okay,
be.
Okay, got it. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Bob in Houston again.
Hello, Bob.
Hi. I was curious about. I've heard about nuclear-powered lasers, especially satellite-based lasers.
Oh, yes.
And also satellite nuclear power plants, if he can explain those and perhaps the power limits to those things.
Okay.
Again, it's not my field.
All right.
I'll take a pass on it if you don't mind. I've not studied.
And have you studied at all the, you know, we have launched, I mean, Cassini and some of these spacecraft we've launched with nuclear power plants on them for satellites for,
absolutely, sure.
Sensibly good purpose. But, again, rockets occasionally blow up, and the story they always give us is that it would be safe and that the nuclear power plant would fall safely back to ground and they would find it and that would be that. Do you think that's...
Well, these are not, today, these are not reactors. What they are is using an isotope of plutonium as a heat source.
Fuel cell, sort of.
As a fuel cell, sort of, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Should that, though, I mean, the question is, should it detonate in the atmosphere?
Well, from what you're thinking of it, just the blading as it comes down through the atmosphere? There'd be no tendency of the thing to explode, put it that way. This is an isotope of plutonium that is not particularly fissionable. It is very radioactive, so it is a good heat source. But its radioactivity again is alpha particles that don't go more than an inch or two away from the surface of the.
I see. So should something like that get scattered in the atmosphere in the worst case scenario, it wouldn't be a problem.
I wouldn't be particular. No, I don't think is. Is a particular worry.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello?
Thank you. Yes.
Yes.
Hello?
Hello. I said at the beginning of the call, you're on the air with Dr. Till. So.
Oh, thank you. I'm Bill from Salt Lake, having a 300-year solution for disposal of spent nuclear fuel.
And what is that solution?
We separate by 5/9, what we call it, 99.999%, and use that for new fuel. And the balance, the fission waste, becomes Class C in 300 years. I could mention names if it's all right.
No, I'd rather you don't, actually. But
okay,
let's ask Dr. Till if he's familiar with this process, Doctor.
I think so. It's not different in concept than the IFR. The idea of trying to get all the man-made materials out of the waste so you're just left with fission products is an excellent idea. I mean, it's more than just an idea. It should be done, in my view. And it simply depends on whether one has in hand a chemical process that will do that in the first place, and secondly, a reactor that will then burn up the man-made elements as we were proposing for the IFR. But in principle, obviously, it's a very, in my mind, a very sound idea.
All right. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello.
Hello, Art Bell. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I've been listening for many years driving truck.
Thank you, Mike.
Dr. Till, I was working for the state of Washington, and there were some professional people that would come in out of Hanford during the time when there was a fire over there. And I was privy to some conversations that talked about radioactivity all over the place on the Geiger counters, but when it came out on the news, of course, everything was all fine, and had the opportunity to talk to some people. The storage of radioactive material over there is just, it's got a lot of the tribal community, and it's still in an uproar over there in the Hanford area.
Mm-hmm.
So my concern, and maybe you could talk a little bit about it, is that some of these products last for 20,000 years or quite a while. What about that story?
Well, yes. First of all, let me ask you, what time period was that?
Within the last 4 years.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm unfamiliar with it, but let me answer the part of the question to do with the long-lived activity. In order for there to be really long-lived activity, you have to be have contaminated with americium, curium, neptunium, plutonium, basically those four elements. The only way I could see that at the Hanford site that could have been so is if they if the source of the contamination was the waste tanks there.
Yeah, in fact, I think that's what it was with some of the waste tanks and being close to the river and the fish and the fishing community.
Indeed.
Yeah. So anyway, that's Art was bringing up the question about the fear factor, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when I hear things like that and you hear the conversation, what the news media was saying to the public, and as I went to work and would listen to these conversations at the office by professional people that were talking behind closed doors, my attitude about it is I don't have any trust in the process.
Well, see, there you are. There you are, Doctor.
That's exactly what I was talking about. Look, let me say something about those waste tanks. That's the principal worry at Hanford, and a very correct one it is, too. I too, would be disturbed if I was living there. What was done during wartime and shortly after in the rush to first of all, win the war, very commendable. Secondly, to protect the country against the threats of the Soviet Union, very commendable. But once that was over, those tanks should have been cleaned up. I mean, there's no reason why a huge effort shouldn't have been made to clean those up, in my view. And so I sympathize with the residents there who are saying, that, look, all those things are still there.
Yeah.
And
Even though that was then and this is now, even now, there are reasons to question perhaps not the pure technology itself, but man's stewardship of it is not a great record.
Well, of course not, Art. I mean, you get dumb decisions in every field,
but the decisions that have to do with
how much money goes into the cleanup of the waste tanks and so on, are made in Washington D.C. by bureaucrats, and the technical people. I can tell you from experience have very little to say about it.
Well, I hear you, but if they make a decision that's poor regarding some interstate highway, well then maybe the there's something wrong with the road. So I'm trying to say the consequences.
I totally agree with you. I've spent a considerable part of my lifetime arguing with these people.
Mm-hmm. Do you get calls from government people? I mean, to testify, to talk about IFR, to talk about what could be done today, if only we would resume.
No. I testified for all of those years in front of all the relevant committees of Congress every year. I got to the point where I knew most of the committee members and certainly the chairman. I would say this, the IFR, talking about the politics of the IFR, the senator that led the floor fight against the IFR in 1994 was Senator John Kerry. And I must say at the time I had not heard of him, and I confused him with the other Kerry. But there is a real political element in all of this, and it hasn't worked to the benefit, I think, of a cool look at what the direction should be in advanced reactor development in this country, given, as we said earlier, the oil difficulties that we're undoubtedly approaching.
Right. All right. You've got a website up. We're just out of time here, but you do have a website up, which we have a link to. What's on there?
What's on there is a public television, WGBH Boston, who carried I was interviewed by a man who won the Pulitzer Prize for the history of the atomic bomb.
Oh, and that interview is on the
website.
That
interview is on that.
All right, we've got the link up, folks. Dr. Till, we're out of time. Thank you so very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Art, for your informed question.
Have a good night. That's Dr. Charles Till.